So this is lecture three, where we're going to part two of the introduction to non-abelian gauge theory, where we include the matter fields. And then we're going to culminate by giving the data necessary to specify the particular Yang-Mills theory corresponding to the standard model. Okay, so here we go. Last lecture, we had this analogy between GR and Yang-Mills, and we ended up deriving the Yang-Mills action and seeing that it was quadratic, whereas the in curvature, whereas the GR action is linear in curvature, and it makes a big difference. And particular quantum mechanically, it ends up meaning that this guy is a nice renormalizable, very well-defined quantum field theory, or at least as well-defined as any four-dimensional quantum field theory is, or any interacting four-dimensional quantum field theory is, whereas GR is non-renormalizable. Good. So in this lecture, I want to talk about, first of all, the general logic of what are the logical steps needed to specify a particular Yang-Mills theory. And then once we know how to specify the data in general, we'll give the particular data that gives us the standard model. And that data will be summarized in a table, which is a table that I hope you all will have tattooed on different parts of your body, because it's a very important culmination of human knowledge. I mean, I personally don't have it tattooed on any part of my body, but anyway. Anyway, I don't know how we got here. So to continue. The basic logic of non-abelian gauge theory, how do you specify one? So step one, you choose the gauge group G. So for example, you could choose G is equal to the group SU3, or for the standard model, we'll choose that it's equal to the gauge group SU3 times SU2 times U1. Okay, so in that specifies what representation, you know, what matrix U acts above each point in space in the language of last time. But then the next step, which we didn't discuss last time, is that we have to choose a representation of the group G. So in other words, a representation means a map from G to the group of n by n to the set of n by n matrices. So we take each element little g in the group big G and map it to a matrix U of little g. This is U of little g is some matrix. And that map, that function U of g, in order to be a representation, it has to satisfy the property that it that U of the product of G1 and G2 is equal to the product of U of G1 and U of G2. So the product on this side, the product on the left-hand side, G1 times G2, that's the product defined in the group. Whereas the product on this side is the product between two matrices. It's the matrix product between the matrix U of G1 and the matrix U of G2. But the bottom line is, it's a representation means it's a map from group elements to matrices that preserves or respects the product in the group. Okay, so and if these matrices that we're mapping to are n by n matrices, we say that it is a n-dimensional representation. And if they're n by n real matrices, we say it's an n by n real representation. If they're n by n complex matrices, we say they're it's an n by n complex. It's an n-dimensional complex representation. Okay, and so in the language over here, where we have this vector space, so if we choose an n-dimensional representation of the gauge group, that means this vector space is an n-dimensional vector space. So, you know, the n by n matrices want to act on some n component vectors. And so these vectors, psi of x, the vector psi of x living above the point x, if we've chosen an n-dimensional representation, it means the matter field is an n component vector. So that's what I've said here. The matter field is a section of an n-dimensional vector bundle now. And then a gauge transformation means that over every point X on the manifold M, we choose an element G of X, an element of the group, and then we map, by the representation, we map that element G of X to the corresponding matrix U of X, which is, in other words, U of G of X. And then that matrix U of X acts on the matter, in a gauge transformation, the matter fields, the psi of X, they transform like psi of X goes to psi twiddle of X, which is equal to U of X times psi, whereas the gauge fields transform a different way. The gauge field in the covariant derivative that acts on psi transforms as follows. A mu of X goes to A mu twiddle of X. It's the transformation we saw last time. We derived in the, or it was given as an exercise to derive it in the previous lecture. A mu twiddle of X is equal to a term that transforms like a tensor, U A mu U inverse, and then a second non-tensorial term that makes this thing transform like a connection, the minus D mu U times U inverse term. Okay. And so those are how the fields are going to transform. And then the logic of step three is that the logic of Yang-Mills theory is that we're going to demand that the action be invariant under both. Well, it's at least going to be invariant under, so in relativistic field theory, a Yang-Mills theory, once we've chosen the gauge group and we've chosen the representation, then we have our gauge field and we have our matter fields. And now the action for that Yang-Mills theory is just the most general function we can write down, the most general function of those two fields, such that it is Lorentz invariant, so is a scalar under space-time Lorentz transformations, and gauge invariant, is invariant under internal gauge transformations. And then sometimes we will also require it to be renormalizable, and then sometimes we won't. So often when you hear people talk about the standard model, what they mean is the model that you get by also requiring renormalizability, which is a model with relatively fewer terms. On the other hand, there's the so-called standard model effective field theory, where you relax that condition and include terms that are non-renormalizable, and then you get a bigger expression with an infinite number of terms in principle. Okay, but so those are the three steps to define the Yang-Mills theory. The Lagrangian is just the most general function you can build from the ingredients defined in the previous two steps.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, yes.
When we define the gauge transformations, they are maps on the manifold. We mean like local gauge transformation, transformation defined in just an open set of the manifold, or are we asking for globally defined transformations, or it doesn't matter?
That's a good question. So the Yang-Mills theory should be, I mean, at least it's believed that the usual definition of Yang-Mills theory, which is, you know, usually when physicists refer to a Yang-Mills theory, they mean that the Lagrangian has to be an invariant under a transformation where above each point in the manifold, over the whole manifold, you get to choose independently whatever group element G you want. You independently choose it over the whole manifold, and it has to be invariant under that. And then a fortiori, and therefore it follows that if you then choose a gauge transformation that's only non-trivial over a finite patch, it also is invariant under that, because that's the special case where the gauge transformation is the identity everywhere else. Okay, now before proceeding further, I'm gonna make a notation change from the previous lecture was in sort of mathematicians conventions. That's more the conventions you'll see when you see more mathematicians or maybe high energy theorists, right? Talk about Yang-Mills theory. where again they take the gauge field to be a, it's like the difference between the, it's exactly this different, this distinction between the two ways of defining the, in the first lecture we saw that there were these two conventions for defining the Lie algebra, the mathematician's convention where the elements are anti-Hermitian matrices and the commutator contains no eyes, and the physicist's convention where the you pull an eye out so that the elements of the algebra become Hermitian matrices, but then the commutator, instead of being equal to another Hermitian matrix, you have to stick an eye in, and it's I times a Hermitian matrix. So same story here, that so far, everywhere that you, so, you know, when introducing the theory, it's nicest to work in this way where there's the fewest possible I's and G's floating around. I'll mention that in a moment. So that's how we did it in the previous lecture. And that's usually good if you're talking about, if you want to talk about sort of exact global non-perturbative aspects of the theory, that's often the most convenient convention to use. On the other hand, if you're a physicist, you like to work with Hermitian things usually by training. And then also there's a way of moving the G from in front of the action where the gauge coupling little G from in front of the action where it's been living so far in our notation, into the covariant derivative itself, which is sort of makes it appear more natural in a more natural way in the perturbation theory. And so anyway, so physicists usually make the following notational switch, that wherever we were previously writing a mu in our previous lecture, I'm now going to write ig a mu, and wherever I previously was writing f mu nu, I'll now write that in my new notation, what I used to call another, yeah, sorry, let me say that a different way. What I used to call a mu in the previous lecture has now been renamed ig a mu, and what I used to call f mu nu, that same object, is now ig f mu nu. And so if you just kind of go through the previous lecture's formulas and make those two substitutions, you can check that they become the following: the covariant derivative, you know, capital D is now partial d mu plus ig a mu. So that's the, and then where this is the Engel's gauge field or the gauge connection. And for the gauge transformation, well, the matter gauge transformation doesn't change. Psi still goes to psi twiddle times u psi, where u again is an element of the representation of g. But the gauge transformation for the gauge field does change. A now goes to a twiddle mu. The first term doesn't change, u a u inverse, but then the second term is now plus I over g d mu u u inverse. The Ricci identity is now that the commutator of covariant derivatives is equal to ig times f mu nu psi, so that ig wasn't there before. The formula for the field strength in terms of the gauge field is now that f mu nu is the same commutator of derivatives as before, but now in front of the commutator of A with A, there's an extra factor of IG. But the gauge transformation rule doesn't change. And finally, the Yang-Mills Lagrangian, the only thing that changes here is that in our previous notation, this was written as plus 1 over 4g squared. Now it's become a minus because we have two i's in front of, you know, two i's were pulled out of the f's, if you want, and the g has moved into the definition of f rather than being out front of the action. Okay, and then finally, we mentioned this in the previous lecture, but just to say it again, so this is all about non-abelian gauge theory, or non-abelian Yang, or AKA Yang-Mills theory. But that's called non-abelian or non-commutative because the gauge group G has a non-commutative product. If we just take the same, all the same story, but with a commutative group G, in particular, if it was a simple, you know, a simple commutative group G, that's just you, that's u and compact, that means we're just talking about u1, the group of complex phases on the unit circle in the complex plane. Then we reduce to, this whole story reduces to abelian gauge theory, otherwise known as Maxwell theory or electromagnetism. When the group G is abelian. So in that case, the transformation matrix U would just be this one by one matrix E to the I phi. And in that case, the commutator of the two guys, the two A's vanishes, because this is actually something we haven't discussed properly yet, but we will in the next lecture, because the A's are linear combinations of the Lie algebra, or the A's live in the Lie, are valued in the Lie algebra of the group G. So since the Lie algebra of this group is a commutative Lie algebra, the only commutator, the commutator vanishes. Okay, so with that notational change, let's now take the matter Lagrangian and promote it. Let's see how to write down, you know, matter Lagrangians that are both gauge invariant and Lorentz invariant. So we'll start with so basically, to add matter, we take our favorite matter Lagrangians that you may have already seen in your in a first course in quantum field theory, and we just basically promote the covariant derivative, the partial derivative, to the covariant derivative in those theories. So let's first just see how it goes for scalar fields. Okay, so first for the action for a real scalar field, you've probably encountered this action. This is the Klein-Gordon-Lagrangian. So we have the kinetic term d mu phi d nu phi contracted with the metric eta mu nu. Minus 1/2 that, and then that's the kinetic term, and then minus 1/2 m squared phi squared is the mass term, and then minus lambda over 4 phi to the fourth is the interaction term you would write down in four dimensions. That's the kind of general Lagrangian for that's the Klein-Gordon Lagrangian with the phi to the fourth interaction. So now what if we were going to make it a complex scalar field instead? Well, we still want the action, we still want the Lagrangian to evaluate to a real number. So, you know, we want the phi to appear in combination with phi star so that they multiply to give a real number. So the kinetic term is now d mu phi star times d nu phi contracted with eta mu nu. And now instead of 1/2 m squared phi squared, we have minus m squared phi star phi. I should say, by the way, there's this convention that this is a kind of standard convention, so it's worth pointing out that when you're dealing with a real scalar field, there's usually a conventionally this factor of 1/2 in front of the kinetic energy and the mass term. In the complex scalar field, the convention is that there's no factor of 1/2. So these both have ones in front of them. And there's assorted conventions about how to normalize these coefficients lambda. So you'll see different coefficients there. Okay, so far so good. That's one complex scalar field. What if we have n complex scalar fields? Well, we can stack them all in a n component vector psi. So these are psi 1 through psi n, these are all scalar fields, so meaning that they're not going to transform at all under space-time Lorentz transformations. So if we were going to try to promote this action to an action for n scalar fields, well, we replace d nu phi by d nu of the column psi, and then d mu of psi star we promote to d mu of psi dagger. So now, in other words, in addition to taking the complex conjugate of the column vector, we also, you know, take the transpose of it so that we can multiply this row vector and column vector together to get a number after we contract the indices as before with eta mu nu, the spacetime indices. And then the mass term, now instead of phi star phi, we have psi dagger psi, and instead of the kinetic term being, instead of the interaction term being phi star phi all squared, we have psi dagger psi all squared. Okay, so this theory has a global symmetry. You can check that the Lagrangian is invariant if you take the field psi now and you send it to psi twiddle is equal to u psi of x, where u is a constant matrix that does not depend on x. So if u did depend on x, this would not be a symmetry of this Lagrangian. But as long as u is a constant matrix, it's not a symmetry. It is a symmetry, excuse me. Okay, so now we want to take this Lagrangian and make it gauge invariant. Well, we can now do that by just replacing partial mu by capital D mu, the gauge covariant derivative, everywhere in the Lagrangian. So we just have minus eta mu nu times capital D mu instead of partial D mu. Yeah, I mean, this Lagrangian is exactly the previous one, but just using capital D mu instead of partial D mu everywhere. You can check. I recommend you make sure that you understand that why this is true. It follows pretty directly from the things we've seen so far, that this Lagrangian is now going to be invariant under the same transformation as before, except that now we can let u be an arbitrary function over spacetime. It doesn't have to be a constant n by n matrix. It can be a different n by n matrix over every point in spacetime. Okay, so that's the sort of part of the action for non-abelian gauge theory for scalar fields. Okay, so like the part of the standard model action for the Higgs field is going to be just like this. In that case, psi will be a two-component vector with two complex scalar fields in it. And it will be acted on by the SU2 and U1 gauge fields and not by the SU3 gauge field. Anyway, we'll get there in a moment. We'll get there later, I should say. Okay, so now let's talk about similarly how to do the analogous thing for spinner fields.
Yes. About the previous slide, is there any particular reason you only consider 5-4 interaction?
No, it was just for illustration. I mean, yeah, just for illustration. 5-4 is what this would be the most general Lagrangian you would get. You know, if you just didn't include the 5-4 interaction, that would be the sort of ordinary Lagrangian for a free real scalar field. And it naturally has a symmetry under phi goes to minus phi. If you ask for the most general interaction that is renormalizable and preserves that symmetry, it's still symmetric under phi goes to minus phi, this would be the term you would add. So that would, if you wanted to justify why you were somehow picking this Lagrangian, so that's probably why it's commonly considered, that it's kind of it's kind of the simplest interacting generalization of the simplest, in the sense of fewest degrees of freedom, quantum field theory. But no, I picked it because it made it easy to see how by generalizing it we would get to this action at the bottom, which is just like the action for the Higgs field in the standard model. And in that case, the logic is a little bit different. I'm not saying this very clearly, but on this slide, to be pedagogical, I was getting to the final line by starting at the first line, which does not really have anything to do with the real standard model. It's just a simple Lagrangian that everyone meets in the beginning of in their first class in field theory, and the idea is just to show how by modifying it, in certain ways you can see how it naturally evolves into the Higgs Lagrangian. But the actual logic in the standard model of how we end up getting this Lagrangian is different. It's that we choose our gauge group, we choose a representation which includes a scalar field in a certain representation, and then we write down the most general Lagrangian we can think of based on that representation. And if we focus on the renormalizable part of that most general Lagrangian, it'll have this form. But that's something we'll discuss more properly later on.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, so let's do the analogous thing now for spinner fields. Okay, so again, basically we want to take the normal, action that you first meet for a spinner field and pretty much just make the replacement partial goes to covariant derivative. So here on this slide, I'm it looks like a mess a big part of the game here is getting to clear about what indices there are and which ones you can ignore when and which ones you have to pay attention to when and which ones are contracted with whom. And so to be clear, I'm including all the indices explicitly on this slide, just to show where they all, just to understand the logic of where they all go. And then we're gonna, again, want to learn to suppress them as soon as possible and just use matrix notation. But for pedagogy purposes, let's have a look at where they all are for the moment. And I encourage you to, it's worth taking some time to make sure you understand that agree with these expressions afterward. So yeah, what you normally see as written as a Dirac spinner psi is actually a four component object, a four component column of four complex numbers. And so I'll use capital Latin indices, like capital A, to denote that's the index on it. That's the Dirac spinner index. So A here runs from 1, 2, 3, 4. So in that language, the normal Dirac Lagrangian that you meet, which you normally have written as I psi bar d slash psi, if I write out all the indices, there's a psi bar lower A because I've taken the dagger and hit it with gamma zero. And then there's partial slash, remember partial slash means the partial derivative partial mu contracted with the gamma matrix gamma mu. So the mu index gets contracted and so it goes away, but the gamma matrices are matrices. Their two indices are both Dirac spinner indices. So it has two capital Latin indices. So that's why this guy has two capital Latin indices, and then it's contracted with psi upper B. And then the mass term is just minus m psi bar psi, and I've just written out the indices explicitly here. So where psi bar lower A is defined to be psi dagger lower B times psi dagger times gamma zero, and I'm just writing out all the indices in painful detail. Okay, good. So that's one spinner. What if we wanted to generalize that to the Lagrangian for, and no gauge fields yet, just one spinner field, the Dirac Lagrangian you first meet in QFT. What if we wanted to generalize that to n spinners? So now psi has two indices. It's capital A index, which is its ordinary spinner index that it had before. That's the index on one spinner. And then there's another lowercase Latin index, which runs from 1 to n, which tells me which of those n Dirac spinners I'm talking about. Okay, so then so the generalized Lagrangian here then just has basically wherever I used to have a capital letter, I now have a pair of capital and lowercase letters that are otherwise very similar and contracted up in the same way. So in particular, psi bar lowercase a bar a is psi dagger lowercase b bar b then times gamma zero, which as before is just a matrix with two capital indices. Meanwhile, partial, partial slash, well, it's the, before it used to just be the product of this thing and this thing. And the only difference now is that just to be pedantic about it, there's also a Kronecker delta, delta AB, which is just saying that the partial is only sandwiched between two psi's with the same lowercase index, you know. So the first fermion gets hit, the first psi gets hit by partial slash and gets contracted with the first psi bar, and second psi gets hit by the Dirac operator and gets contracted with the second psi bar, et cetera. Okay, so now again, we want to, once again, this action now has a global symmetry that rotate, if I take a constant and my n by n unitary matrix, and I take that constant, and I think of I forget about the spinner index for a second, I just think of the column of n spinners here, and I hit it from the left with an n by n matrix, with an n by n matrix, unitary matrix U, you can check that that is a symmetry of this Lagrangian. We want to promote that to a gauge symmetry. Well, again, the way we always do that is we promote the partial derivative to a covariant derivative. So now, again, it's just the exact same action as before. The only difference is that I've replaced the partial derivative here, partial derivative partial slash, by a covariant derivative capital D slash. It has the same sorts of indices. Otherwise, nothing has changed. And now, what do I mean by capital D slash? Well, it's the previous lower partial slash was these two terms contracted with a gamma matrix. And so now, all I mean by capital D slash is I'm adding to the partial derivative a covariant derivative. The connection a mu, and that whole combination is being now. That's capital D mu, and that's the thing that's being contracted with gamma mu to get the slash. You guys, maybe I, just in case this was not the notation used in the QFT course, there's a very common notation that if you have any vector quantity, if you have any vector quantity, and you contract it with gamma mu, that is written as that quantity slash. So I'm following that notation. Okay, and so that's the action for the Yang-Mills, that's the part of the non-abelian gauge theory Lagrangian for the fermion matter fields. That's written in with all of the gory detail of the indices written out. Now, the way we'll normally write this is with these all these gauge indices suppressed, in which case it takes on this much simpler form, which really just looks exactly like the Dirac Lagrangian that you started with, and the only difference is that you replace partial with capital D. Okay, but again, now the point of these lower two lines, which are equivalent to each other, is that compared to this line, these guys now have a gauge symmetry. They're symmetric under psi goes to u psi, where u can now depend on the space-time coordinate x. Okay. And so, fine. So I just wanted to end by going through the logic of how to specify the standard model itself, now that we know how to specify a Yang-Mills theory, in particular Yang-Mills theory. So step one, we want to choose the gauge group G. Okay, so for the standard model, we'll choose SU3 times SU2 times U1. So by the way, what does it mean to be SU3 times SU2 times U1? SU3 is the group of 3x3 complex unitary matrices. Unitary means that U dagger is the inverse of u. So u dagger u is equal to one. So this is, but what exactly does it mean? SU3 times SU2 times U1? Well, it just means, formally it means that each element of this group is actually a triplet of objects, and a matrix G, a 3x3 each element of the group is a triplet of elements of elements G3, G2, and G1, where G3 is an element of SU3, G2 is a matrix in S. I somehow can't spit out the right words here. So G3 is a 3x3 unitary matrix, an element of SU3. G2 is the 2x2 element of SU2. G1 is a complex phase, it's an element of G1. So a single element of SU3 times SU2 times U1 is a triplet like this. And if the product of two such triplets is just the triplet of the products. So it's G3 times G3 prime, comma, G2 times G2 prime, comma, G1 times G1 prime. But so formally that's what this product group is. Now, however, in practice, I must say that the way that everybody thinks about it and works with it, and the way that you should as well, is that what this is really saying is that there's three independent gauge groups, which are all symmetries of the standard model. And so it's like the standard model is, in addition to being generally covariant, or Lorentz invariant, it is also an SU3 gauge theory, and it's also an SU2 gauge theory, and it's also a U1 gauge theory. So in practice, it's almost always easier to think about, you know, these three groups is just acting separately one at a time, rather than thinking of a gauge transformation that's some sort of complicated combination of a little bit of SU3 and a little bit of SU2, et cetera. So in other words, in practice, you can figure out everything you need by always just focusing on, you know, elements of the form. Yeah, just thinking about the gauge groups one at a time. And okay, so step two is we're supposed to choose a representation of G in which the matter fields transform. And here is my beloved table. I think this table is some sort of incredible condensation of human knowledge in a very small space. And when you know, if you specify this table then to anyone, this sort of little 3x6 or 3x7 table of numbers, to someone who, you know, understands non-abelian gauge theory, they can then write down the entire, you know, rule known laws of physics and calculate whatever in principle from them. So it's just a great thing. So what we're doing here is taking the gauge group SU3 times SU2 times U1, and those are those three factors in the gauge group are labeled the three columns in the table. And then the idea is that, you know, the table is, so the representation that the standard model fields live in is broken up into, it's a big reducible representation, and we break it into its smaller irreducible parts. And Wigner's insight was that those irreducible representations of the symmetry group of the theory are what we usually call different particles, you know, different types of particles. So let me remind you that what I mean by a reducible versus an irreducible representation is that, what I mean to say is that, you know, our representation was a map from each group element G to a matrix U of G. So here we're taking each element of SU3 times SU2 times U1 and mapping it to some corresponding matrix. Well, in the standard model, that matrix is going to be either if we just think about the matrix that acts on the fermions for a moment, and then we'll talk about the matrix that acts on the scalar fields in a moment, but if we focus on the fermionic matter fields, the ones that are described by spinner fields, that matrix will be a 45 by 45 or 48 by 48 complex matrix. That's the representation. But the idea is that we can find a basis, we can make a change of basis, and in a certain basis, every time for every group element G, when we map it to the matrix U, we don't get a generic. If we go to the right basis, we find that the matrix is always block diagonal with certain specific patterns. There's certain non-zero blocks, you know, a 2x2 block here, a 3x3 block here, a 1x1 block here. Every element gets mapped to a block diagonal matrix with that same block diagonal structure. And so each of those blocks, but there's no way to find a basis where those small blocks can be further divided into smaller block diagonal blocks. So that's the sense in which those small blocks now are irreducible. They cannot be further block diagonalized by a change of basis. And so these irreducible blocks, then if they're going to be acting on some 45 or 48 component vector, but the idea is that, you know, because the matrices are all block diagonal in the same way, you know, actually, if this is always a 2x2 block here, it always will just act on the top two components of that 45 component column vector. And then the next 3x3 block will always only mix up the next three components. So it's like the top two components of this 45 component vector, and then the next three components, and then the next little section and the next section, they can all be kind of split apart and treated independently. We don't need to think about the whole 45 component guy at once. Although conceptually, from the standpoint of the logic of Yang-Mills theory, it's good to understand it that way also. But so what we have here is that the rows in this table are telling us about what all the different how we've broken up that 45 or 48 component vector into smaller bits, and how each of those bits transforms under the gauge group. So let's see what the table is saying about that. It's saying that these six rows, the first six rows here, are the spinners in the standard model. So these are the matter fields that carry a spinner index, a Dirac spinner index. And whereas the last row in the table are the scalar fields. So these are the guys that don't carry any spacetime index. They don't transform under a spacetime transformation, but they still do transform under a gauge transformation. The top three rows here each row here is an irreducible representation. How do we read this irreducible representation? So this, the first row, for example, says that this irreducible representation, well, it transforms as a three-dimensional representation under the gauge group SU3. It transforms as a two-dimensional representation under the gauge group SU2. And then it transforms with the phase e to the 1/6 times I phi under the gauge group U1. Okay, that's how to read the table. So here U right here has transforms as a three-dimensional representation under SU3, transforms as a one-dimensional representation under SU2. Well, a one-dimensional representation is the trivial representation. So that whenever you see a one in these first two columns here, that's the trivial representation. So that's another way to say that is U right actually doesn't transform at all under SU2. It's a scalar under SU2. And then it transforms under U1 if I choose an element if I choose an element, an element from U1, so G1, let's say I choose the element e to the I phi, and the idea is that if I have a field whose where you have a 1/6 in the final column here, then that field, the group element G was e to the I phi, but the representation of that group element, the one by one matrix that acts on the field in the first column is actually e to the 1/6 I phi. So that's the U1 charge of that first field. Whereas the in the, you know, so that so Q left would transform as e to the 1/6 I phi, whereas U right in the second column has a charge of 2/3. So this under the same gauge transformation, it would pick up a factor of 2/3 I phi, for example. Okay, and so so let's see. So the first three columns in this, the first three rows, I should say, here are the fermions that transform non-trivially under SU3. So those are called quarks. Quark is just the name for the fermions that do transform under SU3. They do feel the strong force. The remaining particles here, the remaining fermions that have ones, again, the one means it's a one-dimensional representation. In other words, each element of the group gets mapped to the one by one matrix one. So they all get mapped to the identity matrix or the identity number, really. So they don't transform. So these are these bottom three are the leptons. Those are the fermions that don't transform under SU3, or physically they're the leptons that don't feel the strong force. It's going to turn out that we'll see if we inspect their Lagrangian, we'll see that the fact that they transform as the one-dimensional or trivial representation of SU3 exactly means that their covariant derivative actually isn't going to contain a copy of the SU3 gauge field. So under SU2, the story is different. Now instead of the splitting between between quarks and leptons, now the splitting is between left-handed fermions, which do transform under the SU2 gauge transformation, and the right-handed fermions, which do not. See that the twos here were next to the fermions that have a little L next to them, indicating that they're left-handed fermions. We'll talk more about that soon. But and then the other guys that don't transform under SU2 all have little sub R's, indicating that they're right-handed fermions. And they all have their own weird hypercharges as well. Okay, so those are the fermions actually of the first generation. You know, an unexplained mystery about the standard model is that this pattern of fermions actually is repeated exactly three times. So really this table actually has 18 fermion rows and one scalar row, but because the 18 are just three copies of the same six rows, you don't write them explicitly. You just think of them. So one way to write that would be to say that these fermions here actually have another index, which is not a gauge index. It's just a family index or a this fact that the six rows are repeated three times. People describe that as saying that one copy of this six row pattern is called one family or one generation in the standard model. And then the standard model has three families of fermions or three generations. So, you know, one way to write it here is to say that these guys all have a family index I, which runs from 1, 2, 3. And then the different, physically we'll see that the only difference between the fermions in different families is that they have different masses. They have exactly the same charges, if you want, same interactions with the gauge fields, et cetera, but different masses. But another thing to say is that they have different names, different conventional names. So the In the first family, we have the up quark, which appears, so here Q left is actually, we'll later see actually contains up left and down left. And then here we have the right-handed partners upright and downright. So the quarks in the first family are called up and down, but the analogous quarks in the second family are called charm and strange. And in the third family, they're called top and bottom. And then the leptons, okay, here we, this L here actually we'll later see contains the left-handed neutrino and the left-handed electron. And here we have the partner right-handed neutrino and right-handed electron. Those are the names of the first generation particles. But then in the second generation, the electron becomes the mu, and the corresponding electron neutrino becomes the muon neutrino. And in the third generation, the mu becomes tau, and the neutrino becomes the tau neutrino. And finally, we have the scalar fields. Well, there's only one irreducible representation of scalar fields in the standard model. Again, no one really knows why. But it is a singlet under SU3, so it doesn't feel the strong force. It does feel the SU2 force, and it does have a non-zero U1 charge. This U1 charge here is not usual electromagnetism. This is called hypercharge, and we'll see how after spontaneous symmetry breaking, a combination of these two things become what you're familiar with as electric charge. It's a different U1 subgroup of this SU2 times U1 part of the standard model. Anyway, let's see. I had just a few more things. I mean, this is just a kind of a very condensed intro to the you know contents of this table. But as I say, these guys in the first six rows are spinners, and so when we quantize, they're fermions. They're described by anti-commuting variables and anti-commutation relations, canonical anti-commutation relations, whereas the Higgs field and the gauge bosons are described are bosons. They're described by commuting fields and canonical commutation relations. And I should say yes. So this table has so far we've talked about the matter fields, how they're specified in the table. But also the top row here specifies the, so these are the, another way to say it is that these are the spin 1/2 particles, these six rows or these 18 rows. These are the spin 0 particles down here. And then the spin 1 particles, the gauge bosons, are specified by this top row. So there's a gauge field corresponding to SU3, which is called the gluon field. There's a gauge field corresponding to SU2, which is called maybe the W boson field or the weak boson field, and corresponding to U1, which is the hypercharge gauge boson. Now, usually, because SU3 is an eight-dimensional Lie algebra, we can choose a basis, an eight-dimensional basis for that vector space, and the coefficients of those eight basis vectors are the what you usually hear described of the eight gluons, and similarly this is a three-dimensional Lie algebra, so there's three W bosons and one hypercharge gauge boson because U1 is a one-dimensional Lie algebra. That's how the table has specifies the representation, which ultimately specifies all the fields, and part of the name of the game is then to see how step three emerges. We're going to want to see in the coming lecture or two how we take the data from this table and do step three. Write down the most general formula that is Lorentz invariant, gauge invariant under all of these gauge groups, and renormalize it. And that's the standard model. Okay, so let me stop there. Any other questions?
I have a question. In the traditional picture of the standard model that we see, I'm not used to seeing like the QL, the left-handed ones, like the QL and the LL. Do you know why that is or what that might correspond to?
Yeah, yes. So we'll talk about that more. That's because, a key part of the physics of the standard model is the Higgs mechanism, which is where this, the one scalar field obtains a non-zero vacuum expectation value that partially breaks the symmetry of the standard model. It doesn't break the SU3 part of the symmetry, but it does break, in a sense that we'll describe later, SU2 times U1 down to the U1 of electromagnetism, the residual U1 that remains in the low energy world that we normally experience. That's why we only see kind of electromagnetism in our day-to-day lives. When that happens, this Q field, which if there hadn't been spontaneous symmetry breaking, we would all think there was a Q field. We would all talk about a Q field. That would be the natural object. There wouldn't be any natural way to split Q up into smaller bits. But after the symmetry is broken by the Higgs field, Q naturally breaks into two objects, one of which is the up left, the left-handed up quark, and one of which is the right-handed, excuse me, one of which is the left-handed up quark, one of which is the left-handed down quark. And the left-handed up quark and left-handed down, the left-handed up quark and the right-handed up quark get paired together into just what you usually call the up quark. And the left-handed down quark and right-handed down quark get paired into what you usually just call the down quark. So it's somehow before spontaneous symmetry breaking, the pattern of irreducible representations, it has this property that it's split into in a different way than you're used to at low energies or that you normally hear about when describing the physics of the standard model. And also it's chiral in the sense that the left-handed fields and right-handed fields are split up in different ways. But after spontaneous symmetry breaking, the pattern of how particles naturally are arranged changes. And that's one of the things that we'll be explaining properly in the coming lectures.
Okay, thank you.
I also have a question.
Yeah.
So, just to clarify, the numbers in some sense represent different things, right? In the U1 column, the numbers represent like the charge in some sense, it's the actual label of the representation. Well, in the other is the dimension of the representation. In the others?
Exactly. Because the representation theory for U1 is different than the representation theory of non-abelian groups. The notation is also different, so it's confusing, but yes, it's exactly what you said. That's right.
Okay, so the next thing is, so in the SU3, for instance, we have three rows with three.
Just to maybe add one more remark that I should have mentioned there. You know, there's a theorem that the only irreducible representations of abelian groups like U1 are one-dimensional representations. So there's no, you can't have like a two-dimensional irreducible representation of a commutative group. But you can have this other phenomenon that they transform as different with different charges, if you want. They transform as different, you know.
Yeah.
Okay, sorry, Andrew.
With regards to that, now with the column, for instance, of SU3, we have, three rows have a three. Mm-hmm. So does that mean, so those three rows are going to mix with one another under SU3, or each one of those rows is a triplet associated to them?
Each of those is separately a triplet. I'll explain this in more, this was supposed to be kind of a blitz first introduction to this. So this table is not meant to be completely clear yet, but one way to think about this is to say that if I was going to put all the indices back in, the first row, you know, you're used to in GR, you can have tensors with different numbers of indices. You could have a vector which only has one index, or you could have the stress, like a tensor like the stress energy tensor, which has two indices. But in GR, all those indices are space-time indices. They're the same kind of objects. So having a different number of indices, all that it does is affect, you know, whether when you do a coordinate transformation, does that tensor get transformed by contracting with a single U if it's a vector, or two copies of U if it's a rank two tensor, et cetera. In the standard model, these fields are very much like that. They're tensors again, but the point, but they can have different sorts of indices. So another way to say what the first row is saying here is that, okay, so Q left, well, we said it's a spinner, so that means it carries a spinner index, A, but it also is a triplet under SU3, so that means it carries an SU3 index, little a, let's say. So that's an index that runs from 1, 2, 3, and it only gets acted on when I do an SU3 gauge transformation. But it's also a doublet under SU2. That's what this says. So I've taken this 3 and I've transformed that into this 3 component index, this index that runs from 1, 2, 3 and only gets transformed by the SU3 transformation. But then there's also the SU2 index, which I don't know, I'm running out of names for things, but I'll call it, I've already used Greek indices for something else. What's another? Okay, so let's say I is the SU2 index. And then U1, well, it doesn't really have a U1 index, it just has a charge. But the point is that if I now look at how this thing transforms under Lorentz transformations, gauge transformations, et cetera, well, it transforms with, you know, under an SU3 transformation, under an SU3 transformation, the A index gets acted on by an SU1 SU3 matrix, et cetera. Whereas if I look at a different row here, for example, the, let's say the D right row, you know, this row, then, you know, D right, according to this table, well, it's a spinner, so it also has a spinner index. It's an SU3, it's a triplet under SU3, so it's a dimension 3 representation under SU3, so it also has that SU3 index, but it's a singlet under SU2, so it does not have an SU2 index. Okay, so this guy only has 2 indices. Does that clarify what's going on?
Just
to give one more example. So this guy, the right-handed neutrino, because it has a 1 in both the first and second column, you know, it does have a Dirac spinner index, but it doesn't have any. So it's just like this. It doesn't have any SU3 index or SU2 index. And under, yeah. Okay, sorry. So you were saying something.
Yeah. There are all 3 rows with a 3, for instance. What is that 3 about? Or it's in the sense of.
Oh, yeah. You're saying on the one hand, these guys have 3s, and on the other hand, there's 3 of them.
And then there's 3 independently, but I never heard about them. Yeah, it's
well, yeah, I had not thought of that before, but the fact that there's 3 of them, like in this 3 rows, that's just unrelated. I mean, it's confusing now that you mention it, but it's unrelated to the fact that these are 3s. It's just these under a gauge transformation. So what I mean to say is that let's look at okay, the name of the game to not be confused in the standard model is to, you know, you have an object which has a bunch of indices, but if you're just focusing on one sort of transformation, you just forget about all the other types of indices and you only focus on the one that you care about. So under an SU3 transformation, how does Q left transform? Well, I just ignore its spinner index and its SU2 indices because those are irrelevant for SU3 transformation. So as far as SU3 is concerned, it's a column of 3 complex numbers. Yeah. And those 3 complex numbers get mixed up by an SU3 matrix.
No, and in a sense, I do think that part was clear for me. Maybe what normally people speak about the mystery of there being 3 families and I don't know. I just wonder, is there an origin for the 3 rows now? Up, down, and Q, what is Q? There's an up, left, and a down left dimension there? Or I don't know, why are there 3 rows? That's, and no one speaks of that as a mystery, and I don't know if that has any meaning right now. Maybe it's still a question.
Well, that's yeah, that's a good question. I know, that's another question that people don't know the answer to. Although, as we'll see later, you know, there's a kind of beautiful observation about the there's a very beautiful observation about the group about, you know, this table looks weird, of course, and a priori these all the, you know, the fact that it's a 6x3 table, the fermions and all the numbers and all the different spots, you know, those were all just determined from experiment. And you could ask, why are they what they are? And nobody really knows the answer. However, there is one very important observation which has been made, which was made in right after the discovery of the standard model by Georgi and Glashow, which is that, you know, if you reinterpret SU3 times SU2 times U1 as a subgroup of the bigger group spin 10, then this whole table collapses to a 1x1 table, which has just one column, spin 10, and just one representation, the spinner of spin 10, and poof. And then when you break the symmetry, when you break the, down to that subgroup, that one representation of fermions breaks up into all of these complicated mess of this 3x6 table. So that is the closest people have come to the at the moment to giving an answer to the question that you're asking about. It's a broader answer of a sort to the question of why this table has the rows and columns that it does.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Oops. I actually have to go. I realize I have a call that I'm supposed to go to go to now. So if there's any other questions, feel free to email or I'll be back at PI next week. So yeah. But otherwise, yeah. See. I got to run. So see you guys later.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.